Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, January 10th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. It's a tool I've been using to great effect for the past almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and to turn any negative emotional state I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. We encourage people to go there, download that tool, print it off, use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your App Store, either App Store, the Google Play or the Apple App Store, and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon-Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process and or given powerful testimonials about how the use of that process has improved the quality of their life and relationships. If you have any comments, questions, if you have a worksheet you would like help with, if you've got a problem and you don't know if the worksheet would be the better tool or one of the many other tools Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice make available would be a better tool, give us a call, 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1, and we can have a conversation. This is the beginning of our new year, and we've decided to work through the way of mastery. And I wanted to begin with the editor's note for several reasons. There are several critically important things in the editor's note. This is a book. It's the big blue book called The Way of Mastery. It was never intended to be a big blue book. It was always intended to be three separate books, The Way of the Heart, The Way of Transformation, and The Way of Knowing. And this book, along with the Yeshua letters and some other books that have been given to us through JM, John Mark Hammer, comprise what might be called the Christ Mind teachings. And the reason for that is because the purpose, the stated purpose in these teachings is to help anybody who reads these teachings to step into birthing their own direct access to the infinite mind, to their, to the teacher, to the Christ mind itself. So I'll just read the editor's note here and then highlight some critical parts. The entire text of the Way of Mastery was originally given as a series of monthly audio tapes that were meant for listening. And what happened was J.M. had had this vision, this teaching, this spiritual awakening experience in his living room. And over the course of time, he got the guidance from that spiritual teacher, the entity some people call Yeshua, some people call Jesus. He got the guidance to sit down with a tape recorder and just let Yeshua speak through him. And so that's what would happen. And then once those tapes were made, after the first tape was made, they had no idea there would be 35 or 36 in total. But he was given the guidance to offer a copy of that tape to anybody who wanted it. And then about a month later, he was given the guidance to sit down again with the tape recorder and just talk. And then that tape would be sent to anybody who had requested it. And they would have this tape for a month to listen to as often as they were called to listen to it and to work with whatever exercises might be given in that particular lesson. And it ended up stretching over a three-year period from 1994 to 1997. So eventually a foundation was created to hold this stuff and to promote it. And they decided to take transcripts of the tapes and turn it into book form. And so in preparing these tapes for publication in book form, minor changes were necessary to enhance readability. For example, references to, quote, listening to these tapes, close quotes, were changed to reading these words. Occasionally, other changes in sentence structure were made to accommodate easier reading. Lesson titles and subheadings were also added. These serve to highlight the main topics elucidated in each chapter. Also, we've added italics to clearly reflect Yeshua's meaning when a sentence could be interpreted in different ways, or to give special emphasis when Yeshua has done so. Very early on in the Way of Mastery, Yeshua makes it clear that he is using a language his readers are used to seeing in relation to him. So throughout this course, he speaks in this traditional Judeo-Christian language. Yeshua's own language of Aramaic reveals that his own view of the supreme source is more of energy, and that this energy can be likened to both a mother and a father. His word for kingdom is Malkuta, M-A-L-K-U-T-H-A, which best translates as queendom. He and his tradition are aware that the divine source consists of and exhibits both feminine and masculine qualities. On a number of occasions in the Way of Mastery, Yeshua refers to the divine feminine and clarifies that he is referring to women as well as men. For example, Yeshua makes it clear that the Holy Child, the only begotten Son, or Sonship, these are all other names for Christ. He defines Christ as the essence of all beings, whether male or female, the offspring of the Creator. In Lesson 27, he refers to both the son and the daughter as Christ. In other lessons, he refers to God, the Creator, as embodying both the divine masculine and the divine feminine. As early as lesson 2, Yeshua writes, quote, "The Father marvels at what you are, knowing perfectly well that you are emerged from her holy mind." In lesson 5, he refers to the source as God, goddess. Therefore, though most of the references to the divine in the way of mastery are masculine, the true meaning is the essence of a combined masculine and feminine, father, mother, the one creator. If you wish to hear Yeshua's words in the original languaging and colorful voice inflections and the very real vibrational quality, the tapes and CDs are available through the Shanti Crystal Foundation, shantichristo.com, shantichristo.com. So on to the Way of Mastery, Lesson 1. As he says in many, many references throughout this teaching, now we begin. And the point of that is there is only the now. Bring yourself into this present moment awareness. This is something that Guy Finley spends a tremendous amount of time working on. Come alive, come awake, be here now. Now we begin. Beloved friends, I come forth to abide with you where you believe yourself to be. I come not for myself, but for you. I come not to teach you, but to love you until you choose. You choose from the depth within your own being to set aside every illusion you have ever given credence to, and to remember the truth which alone is true. As with so many of the paragraphs in this book, if you understood that paragraph in detail and depth, every word and the instruction, you wouldn't need the rest of the book. Second paragraph. For indeed, in that hour, when you choose to set aside every illusion you've ever given credence to, in that hour there is a transcendence of all that knows limitation. There will be no limits to your experience in life. There is a transcendence of all that knows coming and going, birth and death. You will transcend coming and going, being born and dying. There is but the mind of Christ, capital M mind, within which each of us, as a spark of divine light, as a sunbeam to the sun, each of us rests eternally in perfect communion and communication always. The great secret is this is the state of your actuality, your reality. In each and every moment, you abide in a perfect communion with the whole of creation, since all things are but temporary modifications of the one fundamental energy that I have chosen to call the Christ mind, the offspring of the Father. Beloved friends, I come to where you choose to be. And if you would choose to open to that place within the heart and within the mind in which you can communicate with me directly, I will meet you there as well. If you choose to open to that place within yourself, you can communicate directly with the Christ mind, with the Father, with Yeshua, with all the great intelligences. You won't need a priest, a minister, a rabbi, a Dr. Michael Rice, a genie, a Dr. Tim. You won't need a source outside yourself. When you choose to open to that place within the heart and within the mind in which you can communicate with Yeshua, with the Christ mind directly. And if you choose that, he states here, I will meet you there as well. What is important then, by way of beginning, is to consider this simple fact. Your experience is always the effect of where you choose to focus the attention of your consciousness. Your consciousness is itself being unlimited forever, embracing all the many dimensions of creation. You abide in that which embraces all things, in all ways and at all times. In truth, you do not know separation, birth, death, gain, or loss. This paragraph is a direct contradiction to what most of us have been taught in life. So I'll read it again. What is important then, by way of the beginning, is to consider this simple fact. The fact is, your experience is always the effect of where you choose to focus the attention of your consciousness. Your experience is always the effect of where you choose to focus your conscious awareness. As you focus your attention on reading these words, recognize how you, as an infinite being, have deliberately chosen to participate in this as a form of experience. You will hear words that carry certain meanings for each of you. And you each will color that meaning according to the perceptions that you have chosen to place value upon. Does this mean that some are ahead and some are behind? It only seems that way. In reality, each of you is equal. Each of you chooses from your infinite freedom to attract to yourself certain vibrational frequencies, certain forms or qualities of experience. That freedom is what you abide in always, from before the foundations of this world and long after this world ceases to be. Your consciousness was and will be. In each and every moment, you cannot be a victim of what you see, and nothing is outside of you. What you experience, you have deliberately and directly called to yourself. If you hold the thought, I do not like what I have called to myself, that's perfectly fine. For you have called to yourself the experience of being in judgment of yourself. Merely look with the wonder of a child and see what it feels like and ask yourself, is this an energy I wish to continue in, or would I choose something else? For ultimately, when all possible choices within the dream of separation have been made, they have been tasted, they have been felt and they have been known, finally there emerges the still, quiet voice of Spirit, capital S Spirit, that speaks through the soul, whispering of the one truth, capital T truth, the one reality, capital R reality, actuality in Michael Rice's words, the one love, capital L love, the one peace, and the one bliss, that is continual. Ultimately, when all possible choices within the realm of separation have been made and tasted and felt and known, finally there emerges the still quiet voice of spirit that speaks through the soul, whispering the one truth, the one reality, the one love, the one peace, and the one bliss that is continual. Then the soul begins to turn from the things of this created world. It begins to withdraw its attention from all of its attachments to all of the things it has called to itself. Then the soul begins to transcend its sense of identification with the vibrational frequencies it had only meant to play with, and then mistakenly took them seriously. It is seriousness within the mind that is the creation of ego, and it is great seriousness that holds the vibrations of what you would no longer choose to experience within the field of your being and within the field of your soul. As you, the soul, individual divine spark, as you begin to choose to withdraw the attention and the value you've placed upon all things, as you learn to simplify the nature of your own consciousness, as you realize that you can surrender into something that seems beyond you, and that you can entertain the insane thought of trusting the invisible, as that happens, you come more and more to be less and less. And as you become less and less of what you thought you were, conversely, you become more and more of what your Creator created you to be, what your Father created you to be. The thought of perfect love in form, a channel, a simple vehicle through which the love of Spirit can shine forth. Your only task becomes the cleaning of your windows, the polishing of your floors, the weeding of your garden, so that the light can pour forth unimpeded. No longer will you find the need to defend perceptions that you had identified with in error. You will indeed know when you have come to that state of awakening. For you will be able to look upon all created things that you have ever experienced, all reactions you have ever held within the mind, all perceptions, all judgments, all desires that you have ever held for anyone or anything. And as they arise in your mind, they will not disturb your peace. You will look upon everything you've ever heard, seen, thought, felt, said, and done in total peace. So that's the first two pages of The Way of Mastery, Lesson 1, followed or preceded by the editor's note. And I think that's enough for today. It's certainly enough to spend the next few hours discussing. Our call-in number is 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1 and let us know. How does it strike you to be beginning the way of mastery and to encounter such dramatically different ideas from what the culture has taught most of us? Nothing has ever happened to you. It is not possible for you to be a victim. You only always and forever experience what you've called to yourself to experience. You create your experience by how you choose to focus your conscious awareness in each new present moment. 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, Dr. Tim. This is fantastic to hear this again. My book is marked up so much that I probably need a new book. But anyway, there is a sentence in there that I would love to have you clarify. It's on page 3, 4th paragraph down, last sentence. And it is great seriousness that holds the vibrations of what you would no longer choose to experience within the field of your being, within the field of your soul. I just literally don't know how to decipher that sentence.
Okay, what they're saying is we take ourselves too seriously, and the sentence before that says, it is seriousness within the mind that is the creation of the ego. So if you take yourself too seriously, if you take these identifications, these thoughts, these creations of your egoic mind too seriously, then that's what you create your upset from.
I'm going to have to, yeah, okay.
And what it does is it holds the vibration of all those things you no longer choose to experience. Oh, I'm so sick and tired of being sick and tired. Okay, then, yes, but it's such a bad thing. I mean, I was put here to experience joy and bliss, and okay. No, but you don't get it. Woe is me. I'm taking it too seriously.
Yeah.
That's what that's saying, that because if I take myself too seriously, if I identify too much with the thoughts of the ego, that is what holds the vibrations of what I would no longer choose to experience, and it holds them within my field of being and within the field of my soul. So I keep myself stuck in misery by taking myself too seriously. That's another way to say that.
Mm-hmm. Good. I went into my iPhone and thought I would begin by listening to your reading of the as much as you had read, and the icon is there, but it's disappeared just the way you said it. They all disappeared. I don't know why, because I thought they were separate MP3 files or MP4 files that were on my phone.
You thought,
but they weren't.
You had saved them to your phone, right? You hadn't saved them to your phone. You just saved the location on a website that's now defunct.
I got it. So do they exist? I think
they exist. And to get them, you would have to, you know, if I were to give you a link and if I find a way to upload them again, then you would have to download them to something other than a phone. They would have to be downloaded to, you know, a hard drive or a laptop or a desktop as MP3 files.
Okay.
And as we do this year, I'll explore the possibility of making those available again through the graces of AWS, which stands for Amazon Web Services, because that's the cheapest way I know to hold something in the cloud.
Wow, okay. And they could, you could sell them. I mean, they deserve to be, I'd be happy to pay for them. They were a real treasure. What are you chuckling about?
I'm glad you think so. Well, it's not my material. I can't sell it, but so.
You could sell, because you've read it, couldn't, phooey. Anyway, all right. Well,
I would need someone's permission. That's all. I spent years in the diligence of trying to make sure it was a hidden page on my website, and I only gave it out to certain people. Now I'm chuckling because now it's out all over the internet. It's all on YouTube. It's on ChristMind.info, etc. But
your reading problem?
No, the material. But originally, when I contacted the people at the foundation, they said, no, you can't do that. We will come and get you and crush you.
Oh,
and I said, okay, well.
Okay.
Pretend I never called
all
you.
All right.
So that, because I
well,
was, you know, at that point I was so ignorant that I didn't know that the actual recordings were the channeling that they were offering. I thought it was somebody else who wasn't very good at putting it out there. It turned out it was the original channelings that they were offering for a pretty penny.
Wow. Yes, I bet. Well, it's all very interesting, and this is way, even though I have marked this book up, I've been through it twice, which isn't saying much considering how many times you've been through it. It feels very new to me again. I wonder how long it takes to get this into your system and really get it.
Well, and it tells us right here in the first two pages that I read that it's going to be different for all of us because as you focus your attention on reading these words, recognize how you have deliberately chosen to participate in a form of experience. And you will read the words that carry certain meanings for each of you. And you each will color that meaning according to the perceptions that you have chosen to place value upon. You know, as I read that, I'm reminded of the book, Autobiography of a Yogi. Paramahansa Yogananda, are you familiar with that? As a title anyway? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So I was told about that book when I was in college. And my response to it was, that's got to be Satan. I would have nothing to do with it. I was kindergarten, grade school, high school, and college, Roman Catholic. I was in a Roman Catholic college at the time. And I couldn't even tolerate it. But more and more, as I went through the decades, there were very bright people that said, this was a powerful, wonderful book. It's part of my spiritual journey. It's created my life around this, et cetera. And then a number of years ago, I read the Michael Singer book, Untethered Soul, and then the Michael Singer book, The Surrender Experiment. And I thought, wow, he really talks up this Paramahansa Yogananda dude and that book. So I got it out and I started reading it and I was just loving it. And then I got to a part where I just felt sick to my stomach and I closed the book and put it down. But because I'd had years and years of this work, I knew that was in me. Something in me.
Yeah.
From way back when had gotten stirred up. So I did EFT tapping and breath work, and I did Michael Rice worksheets on it and reality management worksheets on it. And I did had somebody do NET to help me clear the energy. And I knew it had to do with that, the way it was clashing with my very rigid Roman Catholic upbringing. And I did enough energy and energy worked it. When I went to pick up the book again, I read right through it, no problem. So it's what's resonated in me. It's the meaning that I choose to focus on certain words. It's the meaning I give to the words that's going to resonate energies I'm holding in me that may or may not be detrimental or useful. And each of us is going to be different. I know a number of people when they hear this where it says, just in the first two pages we already read, you know, your experience is always the effect of where you choose to focus the attention of your consciousness. Well, I know people are just going to be reacting all kinds of different ways to that. We're just a couple pages away from the first axiom. The first step in awakening is to allow into your mind this first axiom of truth. What's that axiom? Nothing that you experience is caused by anything outside of you. your experience, mm-hmm. and you experience only the effects of your own choice. Well, I've had firsthand life experiences. When I read that to people, they want to scream at me. They want to throw something at my head. They run away. They never want to come back to group again, et cetera, because
mm-hmm.
everything in their being is life experience that demonstrates an opposite to that. Or
mm-hmm.
they think, I'm blaming them, or those words are blaming them for everything in their life that they don't like, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yep. Well, so in a weird way, when you're talking this way and we're reading this, I'm reminded of that talk you, that interview you did. I forget the guy's name, but it was Brain Spotting.
Yes,
and
David Grand.
And he, the thing that totally blew my mind about that interview was that he ended up absolutely trusting that the client knew what they needed, and all he had to do was attend to them very, very carefully, focus carefully, and be relaxed and open to whatever, wherever the client would take them, because he trusted that the client would take them both to the healing, I mean, in the best of situations. I'm sure that doesn't always happen. But I've never heard it quite that way, and yet this book is saying the same thing. Everything
yes.
is your own creation, and you're the expert on you, really, basically.
Well, everything you experience is your own creation. Not
right.
everything is your own creation.
Yeah, everything you experience. Good fix, yeah.
And,
so,
and David Brand is not saying that the client consciously knows anything about
no.
helping themselves. But the client's
right.
physical energy system, the body and the brain, contain those things that are creating the disruption and that have the potential for correction, realignment,
right.
flow of energy, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And so the therapist's job is to learn how to listen and interpret that very, very directly and closely, not and he uses the example of the client or the patient being the comet, the head of the comet,
mm-hmm.
and the
mm-hmm.
therapist's job is to stay in the tail, not race ahead, not guess, not, but to constantly validate through the client's direct experiencing whether or not they have processed it, or they're stuck, or they're in the middle of processing it, whether there's more to do, or so that's, it's a little bit deceptive to say words like the client knows, but, you know, we're
yeah,
tied to language.
Yeah.
And what he's really referring there to is the mind-body-energy system, when there's a disruption, when the client has resistance, pay attention. It's resisting for a reason. Don't try
mm-hmm.
to push past the resistance. Work with the client and some of the techniques that he's developed. End up helping the client align the eyes to stimulate parts of the brain, to be in touch with the body resources, and then the shift that needs to happen will happen.
Did he demonstrate that for you? Were you looking at one another? Was it a Zoom thing, or how was that interview conducted?
Yeah, that was done on a Zoom call, but, you know, he didn't do a session and demonstrate it, but, you know, he has a book titled
mm-hmm.
Brain Spotting, and he gives some examples of it in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And the essence of his experience is very much like EMDR. He was first trained in psychodynamic, psychoanalytic work, but he was, he's been a creative mind his whole life, and so then he got into EMDR and found it to be very powerful and effective, but he kept playing with it because that's his nature, is to be experimental. And what he found was that the way they taught it was this rapid eye movements left to right, and he stumbled across how if you slow it down or if you find a spot, if you follow the patient's, the parasympathetic responses, and that you, number one, you have a more gentle processing, and number two, you get more aligned with the connection of listening to the client, and so he found it far more beneficial. And then it eventually led to some kind of, I forget the exact name, he calls it some kind of flow EMDR. And then eventually when he was doing that flow EMDR, he stumbled across a brain spot, something that happened with a patient that he eventually called a brain spot. And then it led to the development of brain spotting over a series of years and experimentations. And so it's very much like other mind-body energy work therapies that are not, and just like the reality management worksheet, it's not changing anything. It's helping us become aware of what our mind is already doing. And then just exploring it and asking to be shown more about it. It's very much like what happens with brain spotting, that there's a lot of sitting, asking the client or the patient what they're experiencing now. And then shift your gaze a little bit over here. What are you experiencing now? It's not, it's just like the reality management worksheet. What's your mind telling you? What's the emotion that you're creating with that mind thought? What's the goal that your mind tells you has to be satisfied? Cancel all that and just ask yourself, what's underneath that? What can you see if you sit with that?
That's a lot like what Mira Rubin does with her work. She lets the client lead the session, pretty much. She's very directive, and she'll say, sit quietly, close your eyes. Where do you feel what you're feeling? What does it look like?
Exactly.
Is it doing anything?
Exactly.
And that's what you're... Yeah, and that's what your patter does, too, if you really do it.
Yes, and that's what the brain spotting does, with the addition of understanding that when my eyes are fixed in a certain position, it's going to stimulate information in my brain. It's kind of like combining neuro-linguistic programming and EMDR. There are so many connections and similarities from one useful technique to another, and the reason for that is because it's all doing basically the same stuff.
But in all of those cases, the therapist is getting out of the way, whereas I've always been
I've always been rather
directive.
Yeah, because that's what you were taught to do.
Yeah. So you probably have an idea of where you want to go with this, but if you don't, I have another thought. Okay. Oh, and if anybody else's hand isn't up.
All right, what's your thought?
Well, it links up what you were saying about your upbringing as a Roman Catholic. I saw a movie suggested by Michael Rice called Show Me the Father. Have you heard of that movie?
Show Me the Father?
Yep.
No, I haven't heard of it.
Well, at first I didn't like it because it's about, it's almost like a proselytizing to recruit Christians. And they use a certain language, evangelical or even fundamentalists, they talk about reading scripture and the scripture will tell you this and that. And I thought, oh my God, let me get through this. Because Michael suggested it for a reason. And the reason was, the premise is God is our father and mother, but they just say father. And any person who hasn't had a healthy relationship with his own earthly father would do well to remember that they have a father already. It's a father in heaven, Jesus, God. It's very, very rooted in the older Christian tradition. And he wanted me to listen to it because my daughter's three boys had a very harsh relationship with their father. And he thought I should have the boys watch this movie. I still haven't decided whether to do that or not, but I talked to my daughter about it, and I don't know whether she's going to be listening to it. But basically what you've been saying about the deep, deep knowledge each person has, if they can just settle down and trust the process, the deep knowledge that each client has was also shown with using this very different vehicle of the Word of God and so forth. But it ends up being about people who, if they read the words of Scripture and trust their own gut, or which is in their case the Word of God, God's voice within telling them which way to go and not go and so forth, it's another angle to the same thing. And the movie just blew me away because it did seem like the very same thing, but it's put in a language and way of presenting itself is just not palatable for many people now. So it's so great to have these other tools. I mean, AA did it, extracted any kind of anthropomorphic God or the possibility of extracting it. So people could just say, well, all I can do is admit that I don't have all the answers and I don't have access to them directly, but there is a power greater than myself that if I settle into myself, I can access that and be healed. So it's like you say, everything's pointing to the same center.
Well, yeah, that's one serious way to talk about it. And the other one is to try and liberate people from adherence to an outside authority.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly is, although you could read right past it, it's certainly right there in the first two pages of The Way of Mastery.
Mm-hmm. Well, The Way of Mastery is great because he says, you are that. You don't need to get it from outside. You are that. That
yes.
is a mind-blowing idea.
Yeah, for a lot of people who were trained and conditioned otherwise, that's radical.
Mm. So I got a mind shifter from Michael. We did the still point breathing session again, which I find I fight it for some reason. My mouth gets dry. I want to swallow. I'm concentrating on the fact that Michael's looking at us through a Zoom frame, and I know he's assessing how we're doing. And so I'm sort of performing there. And then I think, don't do that. Just be natural. Well, if I'm natural, I'll close my mouth and maybe even fall asleep. But whatever it is, there's a lot of garbage going on in my head. And I had serious garbage. And we talked about my monster. And he gave me a mind shifter, which is something like, I have to read it because I've already been doing
it, but
not
exactly.
Did
you say, we talked about your monster?
I have a monster. Monster. Yeah. It is safe and healing for me to embrace and heal my monster and to stay conscious and heal all the hurt from the past and heal by maintaining the entire presence, no, the active presence of love. Well, I've just been dealing with the monster. And that's one of the tools, and I worked on the monster this morning, and all I get is my monster, is my creativity, the best part of me, my liveliness, my the true ability to love, my energy. My monster is my friend, and I can't take away my monster, so I'm stuck there. And, you know, if I don't know what to do with it. I don't want to give up my bond, but I would like to give up anger. So somehow I've got a divided path there. The monster is a good guy and a friend, sort of like a friendly imp.
So how have you defined your creativity as a monster? You've lost me there.
I understand. Well, I've always thought that the devil was far more colorful than the pious guys on the other side. I've always thought that the devil was interesting and lively and had the full spectrum of, that's why people want to have evil in their lives, is because there's something tantalizing and wonderful about it. So I've got a lot of confusion going here. But I've always thought of the monster as being the key to creativity. Access to the monster, the devil, is like an access to being alive. And I've put the opposite of that as kind of rigid, patriarchal dogmatism that's only got about three colors in its spectrum, like a big school marm. So I got a lot of work to do there, Dr. Tim. And I don't mean that you have to do it right now, of course, but my gut, I guess I got there because my gut was telling me, don't give up the monster. The monster's been a friend all these years.
So let me just draw your attention to the definition of words.
Okay.
And what you're describing as a monster and the devil is just, there's just words you have for the totality of life and colorfulness in life and creativity. Mm-hmm. And it's not, there, it isn't actually the devil or a monster. It's just life and the fullness of life. And you're reacting to some conditioning you have from some human being somewhere that says, this part of life is good and this part of life is bad.
Right.
But it's not, that's not the truth. All of life is just life. And when seen through the filter of love, when seen through the filter of acceptance, allowance, surrender, then we get educated. And it looks very different. So I would just start you with that, that your definitions are just coloring your perception as it does with all of us. And so if you back off and just say, okay, wait a minute, this thing I've defined as a devil or a monster, I was conditioned into calling it that. It's just of another part of life.
Mm-hmm.
So in accordance with our agreement, I'm going to turn on area code 541. You're in the air. Who do we have?
It's Celinda here. I am just delighting in your conversation, Susan and Dr. Tim. I'm just chuckling right and left because there are so many touch points for me. I wanted to share one thing about the Holy Scriptures and someone being bound by Scriptures and an outer authority. And when I was an evangelical Christian and I read the Bible over and over and over, what I thought was a future prophecy that hadn't come true yet because my salvation was in Jesus, who was the only Christ, but I kept reading the Bible, And in the Old Testament, right in the Old Testament, it says that you can, that at one point you will commune, I don't remember the exact words, but you will have direct access to the Father, and you won't have to go through an intermediary. Is that what it's called, a mediary? Anyway, and I would hang on to that. And now when I read The Way of Mastery, there it is. And about 40 years ago, it's a process, about 40 years ago, I took Jesus off the cross as my Savior, and I began to see him in all of his humanness, which actually made him more valuable to me than as being the Savior to whom I always had to bow and be perfectly good for, because if I were good, somehow I would earn the salvation that he would give to me. And so I just wanted to share that. I don't worry anymore. After going through so many spiritual traditions, innumerable spiritual traditions, that I've realized what a blessing it is that I can speak all these different religious languages according to my audience. It's like being multi-language. I can't think of the word at the moment.
Lingual.
So I just shared that. Pardon? Multilingual.
Multilingual.
And the other thing about Susan's Monster that I'll say really quickly, I was chuckling because I too had a monster, Susan, and this was in 1987 when I went to get some educational kinesiology training, and I was terrified. I don't even remember exact what the monster was about. It might have been about my being bound in my bulimia of 23 years, almost 23 years. May have been to do with my terror of being in Los Angeles in a strange place, in a strange hotel. I have no idea. But the facilitator took me aside because I was a hysterical mess, and she simply had me put one palm on my forehead, the other palm on the back of my neck, my hindbrain, my forebrain and my hindbrain. And then she had me sit in a chair, and she just had me tell her how I felt. And this monster was horrendous. I mean, this monster was like a gorilla on this huge motorcycle, you know, like one of Hell's Angels, right? And she just talked me through and let me express what I was feeling and what I was seeing and all of that. And the monster literally shrank Susan to this little tiny kid's toy of this little monster, tiny, on this little tiny motorcycle that you would see a 2 or 3 year old going all over the floor with. And I ended up laughing, and I just wanted to share that because it was so introspective. And that perspective came from me with her facilitation.
Boy.
So just hang in there and understand that you created it, and it can't have any more power over you than you give it. We've reached all the way to the end of the hour, so thank you both. I will mute you so you can listen in for the second hour. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice. I will turn on your microphone, so that's fair warning.
Oh.
There you go.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Good conversation.
All right. Have a great show.
Thank you. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Monday, January the 10th, 2022. And I would give you the call-in number. However, today's show is going to be pre-recorded. Michael is actually having some dental work done in Kentucky. And I'm back here in Bristol with Ari Rain. And so today and tomorrow, what we're going to do, we actually have a DVD or MP3 download that is called Mind Body Bioenergetics. And the first hour of it is an interview Mitchell Rabin did. He has a Better World show. And he does the first hour with Bruce Lipton and the second hour with Michael Rice, and shows how from different perspectives that they're discussing the same thing. And so today I'm going to play the interview with Bruce Lipton, and then tomorrow's will be Mitchell Rabin interviewing Michael Rice. So I hope you enjoy. And hold the space for Michael that the dental work goes smooth and he can get back here to Bristol probably by the end of tomorrow. Thank you.
Welcome back to A Better World. This is your host, Mitchell J. Rabin, and today we're going to have a very interesting show yet again. Today we have Bruce Lipton on, Dr. Bruce Lipton, who is a PhD in cellular biology and is a former professor at University of Wisconsin. He'll be speaking to us about his work and study of physiology of consciousness, and God knows where this is really going to take us. So welcome.
Thank you, Matt.
It's a pleasure to have you, Bruce.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Maybe you can enrich upon and expand the little introduction I gave you, because I know it's an arm's length, but I wasn't given all the data.
Well, basically, my work consisted of being a professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, and I was a cellular biologist and teaching medical students for about 20 years this cell biology understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, by training, a traditional allopathic medical researcher. However, about 10 years ago, my research on cell control mechanisms, we think of genes as cell control mechanisms, but about 10 years ago, there was a new vision of cell control mechanisms that said that the genes weren't really in charge, but the genes are somewhere down the list of control, that there are higher levels of control. And so at that time, I started looking at other areas of information handling in the cell, and came upon an understanding that the cell membrane, and the cell membrane is like the skin of a person, and the cell membrane are analogous structures. So to the cell, the skin of the cell is this membrane.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that the cell membrane is the site of consciousness transduction. In other words, it's a cell membrane that selects the programs for the cell, what the cell is going to do,
goes
in and what goes out, but it also selects the genetics. See, so basically then if you're looking at, we have talked for years about genes being, that we are the victims of our heredity. You know,
genes are predetermined.
Yeah, that I've got genes passed down from one generation to the next generation that are shaky genes, let's say, and then therefore I'm going to be susceptible. So we've always had a belief system that the genes are actually controlling who and what we are, so that we are nothing more than the slaves to our genes. This is a current vision, in fact, in the medical sciences, but in the leading edge of research, that vision is now being swept away because there's a very important principle, and basically we've heard it for years, like a gene turns on. This person says, I have a cancer gene, and the gene turned on. This is a
seed ripening.
Yeah, it's just like the gene had a consciousness to itself, and the gene decided it was going to turn on. The important understanding is that we now know that biochemically a gene can't turn itself on. A gene is just like a recorded piece of program on a computer disk. The information is there, but which piece of the program is going to be called up and which piece is not going to be called up isn't up to the computer disk. It's up to the processor. Okay? Well, the idea is that the gene...
The person inputting.
Yeah, the inputting of the information. Okay? It's not the disk there sits there and all of a sudden says, okay, let's turn on this program and let's turn on this program. The disk cannot turn itself on. The genes in the nucleus to the cell, the nucleus is like a hard disk. It's got a lot of genetic programs in there. Every cell has a complete genetic repertoire. And in fact, what it has is two sets of genes, one from the maternal side of the inheritance and one from the paternal side. So you actually have two sets of every gene. Okay? So which genes are being selected to play and which ones are not being selected to play, we used to think was up to the genes. Now the biochemical understanding reveals this. Genes are not self-emergent. Genes cannot turn themselves on. Genes can be turned on, but they themselves cannot turn themselves on. So all of a sudden we say, well, wait, if the genes aren't switching themselves on, and a cancer gene turns on, we can't now blame the gene, then we have to say, well, where is the gene being turned on from? And the part that's real exciting is if you follow the chain of signals and back up to the original source signals, the first thing you find is you're at the cell surface. And when you're at the cell surface, it's the cell surface is like a keyboard on a computer with proteins called receptors as keys.
Is that distinct from the cell membrane?
Yeah, the cell membrane and the cell the receptors are part of the cell membrane. Okay, so that the cell, the skin of the cell, mm-hmm. looks like a computer keyboard with proteins that stick up from the surface with antennas on them, and the antennas are receptors. As receptors, the name receptor means like eyes are receptors, ears, nose, taste. In other words, sensory inputs.
As well as neuroreceptors.
Yeah, well, that's the same. It's the same understanding. It's a neuroreceptor is one of these antennas
yes.
that sits on the surface of the cell, and when a signal comes, it activates the neuron. Okay, so a receptor is a sensory device. And it's on the surface of the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is it's environmental signals that hit the receptors and then call up the program. Now, all of a sudden, it says, now, wait a minute. Before and currently in the medical field, and they're way behind. The medical people are not up where the research is, because medical doctors are trained by textbooks that are present in medical school, which are 10 or more years behind. And we're talking what we know right now, and that is that the genes are switched on and off by signals from the environment. So all of a sudden it says a very simple stand back. It says, is the switching device on the inside or the outside of the cell?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the signals from the environment. So automatically it says that the cell is on, the signals come from the outside. So there's no life per se in the cell. The cell is a biochemical mechanical device. And it's a reflection device. Whatever a signal comes in the system, it's like stimulus response. The important understanding is that the stimuli did not come from the inside. The stimuli come from the outside. And as a biologist, you know, a non-spiritualist and not into the New Age anything, when I was sitting down looking at the biochemistry, to me it's like mathematics,
mm-hmm.
and you follow it back and say, my God, I mean, I transformed my life in a second, because my traditional point of view was, oh, the genes are activating and I'm just an unfolding of my genes. And now the science shows that that is totally not true. That you select, the science shows that you select the genes by environmental signals. A cell's fate is determined by the environment it finds itself in, not predetermined in the nucleus. You take a cell that was going to be a muscle cell, put it in an environment that cartilage cells live in, and it becomes a cartilage cell. Okay? See, so basically we were thinking, well, the muscle cell was determined by something on the inside. And now it's like, no, it's determined on the outside.
Though it were a muscle cell, we're always going to be a muscle cell.
Yes. And then what
and
we find
we
out...
find that there's a program for infinitude within every single cell.
Yes, more infinitude than you were thinking about for the following reason. We used to think, and again, this is real current. It was verified last year, in April of 1994. Okay? It was verified with some very new information. We used to think that the genes were these hard-written programs. You get them passed down, and you get them. And if there's a mistake, it's a mutation, and that's an accident. So that if there's a defect, it was just an accident. Okay. Now we know, all of a sudden, last year, that we can write genes. We can write genes based on our perception of the environment. In other words, we used to think all mutations were random events. Now we know. There's a new kind of mutation. It's called an adaptive mutation. This has been described chemically, you know, biochemically last year, how it works. But it reveals that there's an interchange of information between the environment and the genes, and that the environment can reorganize the structure of the genes. The environment writes the genes. In other words, you take a bacterium that is sensitive to penicillin, a bacterium that would be killed by penicillin,
mm-hmm.
and if you put it in a culture dish and add penicillin, well, indeed, most of the bacteria will die. A large number of bacteria exhibit what we call, they develop a resistance to the penicillin. Well, resistance to the penicillin is because the bacteria created a gene, and that gene makes a product that neutralizes the penicillin. Okay? The gene was not in the bacterium before the penicillin was added. The penicillin was added, and then this gene was created by the bacterium to deal with the penicillin in its environment. Bottom line reality was the environment brought the penicillin in, the cells made a response, and made a complement to the penicillin. That's what the gene was making, a protein complement that plugs in like a lock and key and then neutralizes it. So if the penicillin is free and active, it can destroy the cell. But the cell makes a protein that locks into the penicillin and then neutralizes it. Important point is that the gene was created as a response to the environment. so that our genetic composition is changeable as the environment changes, which is nature's way of conserving the organisms, because the environment is always evolving. And if the organism stayed the same and the environment evolved, there'd be a point where they wouldn't be able to survive in the environment. So what it shows is that over time, the organisms make new gene programs that match what's changing in the environment. Well, now we also know it's not just what's going on in the environment, but genes can be changed by an organism the organism's perception of the environment. In other words, the environment might be totally healthy, but if we perceive the environment as negative, then we will create a gene that will complement the negative environment. Now, this changes everything in regard to what we know about biology, because before we were victims of our genes. Now it says we are the authors of our genetic program.
So what would it mean, practically speaking, then, Bruce, if someone perceived what others saw as a healthy environment as an unhealthy environment? What would be the genetic adaptation to that?
The genetic adaptation.
What would that look like?
The genetic adaptation. An adaptation is a complement to the environment. If it's a hostile, negative environment, the gene will make a program that will complement and reflect that. Just, the genes are like film. They take a snapshot of what they see. So they'll make a terrible inside to balance the terrible outside.
Won't they rally together to create a healthy inside to ward off or protect against?
That's a good point, Mitch. The point is this, is that the research that I carried out, and this was research that was done about 92 at Stanford University in the School of Medicine when I was doing research there, mm-hmm. okay? And we published some papers on the inflammatory system, the immune system. And there's a very critical point for people to understand,
mm-hmm.
that the cells have a repertoire of behaviors, and they could be either behaviors promoting growth, or they can be behaviors promoting protection. But the important understanding is that the cell can't be in growth and protection at the same time. And why this is a very, if a cell can only be in protection or in growth, then the cell must look at its environment and make a decision as to whether a growth behavior is necessary for its survival or protection. If we look outside at the environment and it's a hostile environment, the image of the environment is going to be portrayed to the cells. The cells are watching what you're watching, because you're a collection of cells that are living with your eyes as their world. So basically, when we look out at the world and we say there's a horrible, scary world going on outside, then what kind of response are you going to get? Well, you're going to get a protection response. But protection compromises growth. And so in other words, if you are staying in protection for so long, you actually start to deteriorate. Your tissues start to disease. The analogy is very simple.
Yeah, go on.
I'll give you the best analogy. Back in the 50s when we had the scare of the Russians dropping bombs, we had bomb shelters. Okay? And the idea is a community could be working and happy and everybody's productive and growing. But if an air raid siren comes that is like there's a hostile possibility of being bombed, then the community breaks up. Remember, it's working in a community, and everybody runs to their own bomb shelter, and they hide in the bomb shelter until the all-clear comes. Okay, now, the point is that the community is productive. The moment everybody goes in the bomb shelter, the production stops. And then the other thing is, how long can you stay in the bomb shelter? Because there's a certain amount of food, which is okay. So in other words, acute little attacks of scare and stuff like that, no big deal. But if you live for a long time period under a threat, then what happens is, if you live in a bomb shelter, at some point you're going to run out of food and water. And the moment you run out of food and water is when you begin to die. The cells can get into a protective posture, and they will stay that way until the all clear comes. If there's no all clear, they'll stay that way, and then slowly they'll start to die out, because it's like being locked in the bomb shelter
right.
for an extended period of time.
It's like the body has to spend most of its energy taking care of itself.
In protection.
In protection.
Yes, because remember, taking care of itself in growth is one thing. That's growth is another way of
that's
life,
right.
okay?
Of course.
But protection, that's a totally different, that's like spinning your wheels, because you're using a lot of energy, but you're not going anywhere. And that's the thing that compromises us. But look where we live. Look, you watch the news, read the papers. Everything you see is violence and protection and protection. So we're in a constant and chronic state of protection, all of us. And as a result, we are becoming weaker and weaker as we go on. Why? Because we're so afraid. And if we can get out of the fear, then we can get back into the growth.
Wow.
But I think there's a much more exciting understanding, because, you see, okay, look, I remember I was a typical allopathic research biologist carrying out standard life in the cell, you know, genes and biology and all that stuff. But when the understanding came to me that it was that the cell membrane, that the signals from the environment were going through the cell membrane and then selecting the genes, for a biologist who was non-spiritual, what it immediately said, it's not like ambiguous. What it really says is, life is not inside the cell. The signals that are responsible for selecting the behavior of the organism are the environment, which immediately said to me is, well, then this is like a biological robot. The cells are a machine. They're a virtual reality machine because they transduce the environment. They take signals and convert it into information which is sent back out of the system. I'm not in my cells, which meant that if my body wasn't here, the environment's still here. And if the environment's still here and I'm in the environment, then what it would automatically imply is that we are immortal. Because we are the environment. The bodies come and go, but they're like biological robots. Like I said, they're like radio-controlled robots. If you have a radio and you're listening to like a little Walkman, and you're walking down the street, and the batteries go on your Walkman, and you say, the radio is dead, okay? Well, the radio might be dead, but the question that we have to ask is, did the broadcast stop? And the answer is no, the broadcast is always there. It's the radio that's coming and going. We as biological bodies are like these radios. We come and we go, but we're tuned. Each human is tuned to an individual station, and each cell is marked with a tuning device. In biology, we call it the histocompatibility antigens. It's a complex term, but what you might be familiar with is you can't take a transplant from my body and put it into Mitch's body and expect it to take. Why? Because he has what are called self receptors. I have self-receptors on the surface. Remember, these are the proteins at the surface. My surface receptors are different than yours. All my cells have the same receptors. All your cells have the same receptors. All your cells have the same receptors. The significance is this, is that your cells are tuned to a station. My cells are tuned to a station. If you try to mix two bodies together, it's not going to work because the cells of the body, the main body, are listening to broadcast A, and they may be saying, go to the left. And the cells that are transplanted may be listening to broadcast B, and they'd be saying, go to the right. And so what the immune system is designed to do is to remove any cells that are not listening to your station. That's what the immune system does. It knows self. And anything that's not self, it gets rid of. So what
considered foreign, alien, a pathogen.
So what is self? Self is a series of receptors, but the receptors are antennas. So if they're antennas, then the self is not in the cell. The self must be the signal that's coming across these antennas. Immortality. Totally. I was blown away.
I appreciate the inference that you made.
I was blown away because my whole life said, I mean, I was so trained 40 years into this belief system, and then in a fraction of a second it said, my God, 40 years of this information was wrong. The control is on the outside. Why that's critical to us, though? Look at what we're doing to our environment. We are the environment. We are a reflection of the environment. As we trash our environment, the people become trash in the environment. The people are a reflection of our environment.
Very true. But can we just go back to something?
Sure.
Okay. Speaker, this is beautiful. The inference that you made, because you located self outside the receptors of the cell,
yes,
right? You made a wonderful leap that I appreciate, but many may not follow altogether. It was sort of like going from first gear to fourth.
Yes, yes.
From self as located outside the biology, personal biology, to immortality.
Yes, well, I mean...
So could you step that down a little bit, up as it may be?
Okay. Let's try a simpler understanding. I have a cell. And if the control is in the nucleus, the genes, where the genetic, you know, that's our belief system. Our belief system actually gives the analogy that the genes are the brain of the cell. They control the cell. The brain controls my body. The genes control the cell. That's a belief system.
That's right.
Now, the question is very simply answered. Is this true? And the answer is, if you take the brain out of any living organism, there's an immediate consequence, and we know what it is. It's going to die. It's going to stop the moment the brain is pulled out. But if you take the nucleus out of the cell, you don't stop the behavior. Behavior still goes on. So the reality says, wait, the behavior can't be controlled by this. It's not even in the cell anymore. So it says, wait, so where's the control coming from? Why is the cell moving this way, or why is it behaving this way? Why is it getting in a protective posture? Why is it making this product now? These are the behaviors. Where are these behaviors being elicited from? Who's making this happen? So we know it's not the genes, because we can take the genes out and still have the behavior. So here's what you can do. It's an experiment. Go to the surface, the membrane, the skin.
Mm-hmm.
On the surface are those proteins, receptors that are sticking up like antennas. If you take an enzyme, which will eat up the antennas, and chew up all the antennas on the surface, the behavior of the cell stops. There's no more behavior. Then the cell will replace the antennas. It's like shedding skin. It will replace the antennas. When the antennas are replaced, the behavior begins again.
Same behavior.
Same behavior.
Because there hasn't been new input to change them.
No, same behavior in this case. But you can change, you know, you can change the behavior. It's different receptors. So in other words, it's exactly the analogy. And I don't want to use the word analogy, because I really want to use a more important, more heavy word, homology. Homology meaning, analogy means the, I was going to say the analogy, the cell is like a computer chip, okay? That's not true. It's more correct.
Well, that's a simile, yeah.
Okay, it's a homology. The cell is a computer chip. The mechanism of how it works is it's a microprocessing system with stored programs in it. And as a microprocessor, there's a data input terminal. And the data input terminal selects the activities out of the available programs. The activities are the behavior. So who selected the behavior? It wasn't inside.
There's this idea, you keep positing this notion of self,
yeah,
which is that there is some animate intelligence that is directing the show. And it's happening on that level of, I mean, we keep wanting to locate it.
Yeah, but we look inside, and this is our error, because biology has taken us to always look to the inside.
We see that it's not on the inside as we classically think about it.
Right.
But we can't altogether say that it's on the outside either, except that we know it's, how do I put it? It's not on the inside, like you can't study the cell and find self. But you will find that TV, you'll find the station.
At the surface.
Right, which is a unique vibration,
right,
that is referring to this notion we call self.
Right. There's a signal that activates the receptor. In other words, you have an antenna.
Yeah.
If I have an antenna means it receives a signal. Okay, so the idea is if the antenna is on the surface of the cell, the signal is coming from the outside environment.
Right.
These antennas have a special name. They're called biological self, or I mentioned the more official name, histocompatibility antigens.
Right.
And they are what distinguish self. Why people are not the same.
From
not self. Why people are not the same. And so what is it that makes me different than you? Well, it's these antennas. Well, that's the physical difference. But the idea is it's what the antennas are receiving. An antenna that receives, it's like if your television set has an antenna on it and there's no signal, you turn on the television, there's nothing going on.
And the information that we're giving it is our unique interpretation of what's going on in the world.
Right.
In the environment.
Right. The environment is using us like a keyboard, and we're making a reflection.
Except there's also a level of, you know, you've now opened the door wide. There is a level of will and choice within.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
See, what you're positing here, of course, you know, and when I say what you've proven.
I don't know. Proven by what we're talking about.
What has been, you now say you know for sure.
Well, I know that the signals come from the outside. Now we just have to, you know, look at the spectrum.
But what you've done is you've placed the information of genetics into kind of a hierarchy.
Yeah, and it's not at the top. It used to be at the top.
Right.
In the current view in biology, there's a dogma, okay? And the dogma is, you know, like this belief, concretized belief. The dogma is phrased the primacy of DNA. The primacy of DNA means that the DNA is first cause. Okay? So in biology, the first cause of life, why there's life, what it does and everything, when you say the primacy of DNA,
in the beginning there was the genes.
That's exactly what the biologists are saying. But now we understand, wait, the genes can't turn themselves on, So something above must be signaling down to the genes.
It implicates intelligence.
And there's intelligence in the environment, yeah.
Right.
Now, there's free will and there's all, you know, here's an interesting aspect.
But see, what you're setting up is a biological basis for what we refer to as mind-body interaction.
Exactly.
Right?
This is precisely
there,
what it is.
I mean, you are setting up the how, the mechanism by which mind or choice, free will, is directly affecting cellular life.
Exactly. The research at Stanford showed this in the tissue culture. In other words, what you could look at in the research showed was that there, for example, in the blood vessel where there's an immune response going on, okay, or not. Before there's immune response, remember, it's in growth or protection. So before there's immune response, the blood vessel is demonstrating what we call homeostasis, growth, balance. But as soon as a signal comes in, that there's a need for an inflammatory response, for protection, the blood vessel changes its structure to accommodate protection. So the fact is it has two structures, one for growth and one for protection. They're not the same structures. You can't do both of them at the same time. What the research also showed was that there was a local body response that could carry out this switch, okay? And there was a mind response through two different chemical pathways.
Oh.
See? And then there was, so in other words, the mind could send a chemical down and activate inflammatory response on the same cell. The same cell has a receptor for the mind, has a receptor for the local body. The histamine receptor for the local body, and there's an epinephrine, norepinephrine receptor for the mind on the very same cell. So the cell is waiting to hear from either the local party or
the
mind party. Yes, but and also what the research showed was that if you give, contradictory signals, the mind signal would override the body signal. So our perception, if we thought we had a need for protection and the body says, I don't see a need for protection. The mind says, but I think I have a need for protection. Then the mind will override the system, create a protection response, and the body will then start to degenerate if you don't relieve the protection response.
Something else that you're raising by omission is, in what I'm hearing, is that you say there is growth, there is protection.
Yes.
What about decay?
Decay is, that would be in the...
As in degeneration and death.
Yeah, but you see...
Or is that just a consequence of overprotection?
No, decay, you can have decay during growth. In remodeling a system, you have to rebuild. Look, when you like set up a building, you put up scaffolds, and then you take a building, and then you take the scaffolds away. In setting up a system, you put up cells to create, like before the hand is formed, it's like a paddle. So that there's a complete like webbed structure here.
Mm-hmm.
But just before it's born, the cells in here undergo a programmed death. And so in other words,
they have to die off.
They have to die off. Well, yeah, otherwise you would have webbing between
That's
your fingers.
Right. Yeah.
So decay
is
just when the cells are no longer viable or needed. It could be in a process of growth, and it is most certainly associated with a process of degeneration. Okay? So decay is not its own.
Coming out of protection.
Yes. Oh, protection. Remember, as we said, if you don't feed the cells, after a while, they'll start to decay, and then you have to get rid of them. Okay? So basically, decay isn't its own category because it can apply to either side. The two categories are still growth and protection.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. And decay is just implied in both processes.
In both processes. Where it's needed, it will be used. It's a process of keeping the system clean. Okay.
So this was quite a eureka experience that you had.
As I said, it changed my life in a millisecond. See,
yeah.
Unfortunately, I didn't have to go like on a devotional trek and go like, do I believe this? Because I was doing this empirically as science. So when I sat down, it's just like if you add 1 plus 1 plus 1, the number is 3, and you can feel pretty confident with that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I started laying out the sequence of information flow and got to the fact that it was at the membrane, to me, that as a biologist and as a researcher, that was the equivalent of 1, 2, 3. And when I added them up, and it's like, oh, my God, this is nothing like what we expected. And that was 10 years ago, and for the first few years, I kept thinking, wow, this is, so offbeat, because none of my colleagues could, they looked at me as like, well, you're really weird, okay? But now it's so into the main science that, it's trickled down in 10 years that now I'm sitting here thinking, oh, my God, I should have written this up a long time ago, because now it's coming out. And I'll give you an example. It was, I think, 3 years ago now, two or three years ago in San Francisco, the American Society for Cell Biologists. Now, this is a very large contingency of cell biology people, 15,000 biologists, okay, coming to meet in San Francisco, and they had a series of seminars, and they had titles for the seminar tracks. And when I picked up the program, it really just knocked me, because there was a program entitled Half the Secret of Life is Outside the Cell. And it was a series of seminars all associated with membranes and receptors. And that was like tongue-in-cheek, but to me it was like, this isn't tongue-in-cheek, this is what I've been talking about already for 5 years, 6 years, you know? So it's like, oh my God, they're saying the same thing. So now it's like I am so much more, you know, I tell you, I was very, very insecure, because it's like, why am I the only one talking about this stuff?
Well, when you made the discovery, you shared it with some of your colleagues, no doubt.
Yeah.
And were they able to follow
the same logic?
No,
they could follow the logic.
Right.
But look, it's just like me. If I'm 40 years old and I've trained for 20 years of higher education and doing and teaching and research for another 10
right.
or whatever I'm doing there, you just don't go up to somebody and say, guess what, everything you know is wrong. Because to me, I had to go through the whole experience of it. Just to tell them, it's like, that's really interesting. You know, we talk like at lunchtime seminars. And we talk and they go, that's really interesting, but it's 1 o'clock and they got to go back to work. And whatever we talked about was sort of like, that was a nice conversation, but it's like,
smoke.
Yeah, but it's like, oh, wow. But now the changes are coming very quickly and very rapidly, and it's real exciting for me, because like, oh yeah, because there's so much to know.
You were ahead of your time,
but it's fun because there's more to know. That's the principle. That's the first principle. But if you start to build on that principle, what does that mean about evolution and life and all that? It changes the whole thing.
What inferences have you drawn that you would like to share with us?
Well, the most wonderful thing is that Charles Darwin was totally wrong. And why Charles Darwin being wrong is important is, remember, our perception.
There's many people in today's world who.
This Week in Time magazine.
Completely.
This Week in Time magazine, the cover article in Time magazine is Charles Darwin is wrong.
Really?
Yes. This week's issue of Time, and why this is very important is understand. No, I'm not. I'm doing my own thing out in the field somewhere, okay? Why this is very important is, as I said, remember, it's our perception of the environment that determines the programs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Charles Darwin's perception of the environment became our perception of the environment by teaching.
Sure.
Charles Darwin's perception of the environment that life is a struggle, the struggle for existence, that life, that in fact, the driving force behind evolution, according to Charles Darwin, is the struggle of nature, the violence of nature. So what we have built in is an understanding that all of nature is violent, that we are inherently violent because we're animals and all animals are violent. And the fact was, if Charles Darwin's perception is wrong, then our belief about us being violent is wrong as well. It's something we believe and we created because that's the belief that came into the system. Remember, the system responds to the environment. If the environment says that life is violent, then we will become violent. That's part of our lives.
Absolutely. But certainly we can all notice that violence didn't begin with the advent of Darwinian theory.
No. But see, what happened was that violence is a part of nature in a sense that there's a food chain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If you're in the middle of the food chain, you're going to eat an organism. To that organism you eat, you've made their life violent, right? But if you're in the middle of the food chain, there's going to be an organism that's going to eat you. If you're in the middle of the food chain, you're not going to escape violence because somewhere along the line you're going to be stalked by
sure.
something that's going to get you. So your life is inevitably going to be violent. What was different is the human species is not in the food chain. The human species is on top of the food chain, which all of a sudden says, wait a minute. We don't have violence from above. There's nobody that should be stalking and eating us. And so our belief that life is violent is true for everything in the food chain, but not for the species on top of the food chain.
Yeah.
And when you get on top, we shouldn't have violence. Violence was originally a part of survival to get food and keep food and protect territory. Now, with our technology and all this and all the food available, there's no biological rights for violence. And we shouldn't have that. Our violence isn't biologically oriented. Our violence is socially oriented, materially oriented,
sure.
ideologically oriented.
Sure.
Our violence is taught to us by other people. Filters come through and we become what they say.
Well, how do you explain hunting and gathering?
In what way?
As an
But we're not hunting other people.
Well, I understand.
So that people shouldn't be afraid to walk out the door that some animal is going to come and eat them. That would be the only violence that nature would normally give us, okay? But since we're at the top, and there is no organism out there that, you know, will open up the door and it's like, boom, okay? If that organism doesn't exist, then when you should be able to walk out the door with no fear. Because what the only thing that should be fear is nature, because you're going to eat nature. Nature should be in fear, but you yourself.
The lions should be running from us.
Yeah. In fact, they, you know, when we were smart enough, they are not a predator of ours.
And in fact, right, when someone has conquered fear, and this is something that's come through the martial arts and other lines, that when a person has conquered their own fear, the lions are tame and friendly.
Yes. Yes, the Tellington touch. She's gone in. Linda Tellington, I think that's her name. She's a woman who has trained horses. Everyone who has horses knows of her.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a communication thing with going into wild animals with an open heart and no violence.
Mm.
And she can walk into a cage with a lion and stuff like that and just go in. And by being cool, there's no violence. You know, so it's like, yeah, we walk in afraid, and you can know that lion's thinking, well, there's some meat.
That's right.
Yeah.
In a sense, we're not acting in our full humanness at that time.
Yeah, we're acting in fear.
By fear.
Yeah, and this is the issue. But fear is what gives us a protection. Fear is giving us the degeneration of our lives, the degeneration of our civilization.
Exactly. So what you're really saying is that as we are on top of the food chain, in a sense, for us, anything goes. Peace. Paradise.
That's what we were. That's what we should be entitled to.
Right.
There was no reason. The only reason, again, in violence in nature is if you're going to be eaten by a predator. Number one. Number two, that if someone is challenging you for your territory, which you need to live off of, you need to eat food. You need to hunt in this area. So an animal marks out an area. It doesn't bother another animal down over there. It just has its own area. But another animal can come in, and even before they go to violence, they always check each other out, and they give threats and all that, and then they usually avoid the violence.
So what is, I'm just changing
go ahead.
Step a little bit here, to look at the role that language plays in the influence of our cellular life, our cellular behavior.
Okay.
Have you looked at that?
Yeah, well, you can understand.
This is part of our station.
Yeah.
Our voice, our sound.
Exactly. It's the way signals are coming in.
Yeah.
Okay, so in other words, you respond to the environment. You can respond to the environment directly by going out and experiencing the environment, okay? But you can also respond to the environment by having someone teach you something about the environment, you not having experienced it. So in other words, through language, I can get an artificial experience of the environment. If the language gives me a negative experience, then the language will translate itself down physiologically into a negative biological experience. Okay? On the other hand, language can make everything better as well. It's just how you use this language. But the cells, here's the point that might be interesting to look at it this way. That a human is made out of 50 trillion cells approximately. 50 trillion is a number that's beyond our comprehension. So it's numbers beyond what we can imagine. Yes. And the interesting thing is every individual cell is a free living entity. And my research in cloning cells in a laboratory, look, you can take a cell out of a human. It's its own, like an amoeba now. It's out of the system. And so the reality is the human, what is the human? Is it one organism? No. The human is a community of 50 trillion cells sharing lives together. If they live happily in harmony, the environment and the community works well. But if they live in fear and are afraid of what's going on for their own immediate survival, which means the collection, it's like we as a population look up and maybe a comet is coming and we freak as a whole population. Well, to the cells looking out our eyes, because the eyes are like CNN, the input system is like every cell is like monitoring the whole thing, what's going on. So the cells get a perception of whether the whole organism is in a state of health or growth, or the organism is in a state of protection. It's exactly the same as a nation with individuals like us being cells in a larger community.
Being afraid or not being afraid.
Yeah, but how do we know that? Collectively we know because a broadcast comes over the television set and says, you know, desert storm, be afraid. Okay? Well, the cells are sitting inside us. Our eyes are the cameras, the CNN. The voice, the talk, the language you talked about is the audio portion of the channel. So when the cells are inside, they can't see what's going on down the block, but you can tell them. If you tell them something scary is going on down the block, the cells inside start to figure, geez, are we going to make it as a whole living thing?
Sure.
So you have to start looking. It's like you're in a community. And there,
you don't want a group of cells to start revolting.
No.
Can you imagine?
It's called cancer.
Yeah.
They pulled out of the system. They said, I don't want to follow your system anymore. And that is what cancer is. It's a bunch of cells that decide that they can live outside of the rules of the system.
Uh-huh.
And when that happens is they destroy and distort the system so much that the whole community is going to suffer.
There are lots of, if you follow this, I know it's not just a metaphor, but it can be interpreted as such. If you use the biology, personal biology, as a metaphor for social, social.
It's more than a metaphor.
Development.
It's much more than a metaphor because it's a repeating cycle of evolution. In other words, if you go to the cell, go back a minute to the question of the cell. Where's the awareness coming from in the cell? Remember, we talked about the skin,
yeah.
Right? And that the skin has these receptors on it. The receptors take a certain amount of area. I can only put so many receptors on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
If I want more receptors, more awareness. If I want more awareness, I need more receptors.
Mm-hmm.
If I need more receptors, I need more surface. Look at the evolution. You see, this is the book I'm going to write. It's really about a theory of evolution. Okay, because it shows that the single cell evolved first to handle information in the surface area. The most primitive cell just has a membrane around the outside. And then as the cells got bigger, they started sticking the membrane in the inside, more surface area, and they started sticking membrane on the inside, membrane on the outside,
mm-hmm.
and they created the single cell like the amoeba.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was to make more surface area, you'd have to add more membrane. But if you add too much membrane to the cell, it's like a water balloon. If you fill up a balloon with a little bit of water, you can throw it all over the place, no problem. But if you take a balloon and fill it up with a lot of water, meaning the surface is getting bigger, there's a point where the surface can't hold the cytoplasm because it'll rupture. So you fill up a balloon with a lot of water and try to throw it, and just moving it, the membrane will rip. Okay? Well, in a biological cell, when the membrane rips, that's the death of the cell. Okay? So basically what it says is this. You can make a cell to a certain size like a water balloon. It goes up to a certain size and it's safe. If you try to make the cell bigger, now it'll have a tendency to rip. If it rips, it's not going to survive. So what happened is evolution was making a bigger and bigger cell until it reached the protozoans, and then it couldn't make any more evolution. And evolution stayed flat in our world history. It stayed flat for a couple of billion years, only single cells. And then single cells thought, I know how to get more surface area. Well, they were trying all new things. It wasn't that boring. It was pretty exciting, in fact. What they found out is that if you take two cells and plug them together electrically, so they created in evolution a coupling like a computer plug.
Mm-hmm.
And the coupling called a gap junction allows two cells to plug in so that the membrane activity of one is electrically carried through to the membrane of the other. So two cells, instead of acting as two individuals, could come together and share their surface area. Well, immediately, two cells have more surface area than one cell. Logic. Surface area is related to awareness. So the next phase of evolution was making all new assemblies of cells, all these various forms of cells.
All electrically connected.
All electrically connected so they could share the community. That's the way it works. They're all electrically connected. And so what happened was the first phase was to make the cell, and the second phase of evolution was to make an organism made out of cells. That was us when we ended the evolutionary tree. I mean, all the organisms in between. But when we evolved, that was like maximizing the potential of the system. It's like the amoeba for a single cell. We are the maximum potential for a single organism. So what happened is just the replay of evolution. The single organisms hooked up with other single organisms to make community to share information. Society. The structure...
Computer network.
What we're doing now, the internet is the same electrical coupling that the cells use to couple to each other so everybody can share information simultaneously. We are in an evolutionary, the part that's beautiful is that there's a pattern. And when there's a pattern, then you can say, well, where are we? And we're at the most exciting stage in history
mm-hmm.
because there's a redundancy of the patterns. And the pattern is, whatever the animals went through in their evolution, we as a society will go through the same kind. Okay? just to give you, I know we don't have a lot of time, but I'll give you just the last couple of phases. The vertebrate level of evolution, we went from fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals. Well, society will go through a fish society, a reptilian society, amphibian society, reptilian, an avian, a bird society, and then a mammalian society. Where we are now is the reptilian society is the one that's running the show, the big monsters, the big dinosaurs, the big machine companies, you know? And these are machines, but what's their problem is like the dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are reptiles. They are conscious for the moment, but they don't have a future. They live right now. The future means nothing to a dinosaur. It only knows if it's alive now. And what happens is, of course, without knowing about the future, without understanding the future, you can destroy yourself before you get there.
Mm-hmm.
The dinosaurs died out, okay? But in our case, we are in the process of our civilization, our dinosaur-type civilization. And there's much more to this I can tell you. I can't really say it in this very short time period. I'd like to tell you about
all of evolution in a few minutes.
Because basically what we're dealing with is this. This is what dinosaurs were doing. But what happened, what the dinosaurs did, why they failed, okay? Remember, evolution was making more awareness. But the dinosaurs went on a different track. They made bigger size, less awareness, meaning you can have a 50-ton brontosaurus, but how big is its brain? It's only this big. And in evolution, the normal path of evolution is to make the brain bigger and bigger and the body more controllable. But dinosaurs said, hey, we can survive by just being bigger. Because if you're bigger, you can step on something smaller. It didn't take much intelligence, and it was easy to do. And it's interesting because we talk about mind-body relationships.
Yeah.
What is the body to the mind? The body to the mind is, the body is the administration. The mind is awareness. The body administers to the awareness, meaning, what is the body for? Because the mind says, go left. Well, the body makes the left. The mind says, go get that piece of chocolate. Okay? Well, the body go gets the chocolate. So the body's carrying out
the orders.
So the body is the administration, the brain is the awareness. And in dinosaurs, like the kind of civilization we're dealing with now, is we have so much administration and so little awareness that we as a population are dinosaur-like in this case. Okay? We're even living off the... we're living off the fuel of oil. Dinosaurs.
Reptile fuel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now what happened was the birds flew up above the dinosaurs. The birds were the next level of evolution. Birds had a perception. They were up high enough to see things.
Yeah.
And they could see things and they had a better vision. And then later from the birds came, through the birds or after the birds came the mammals. Okay?
Yeah.
After. Now, go to our civilization. We're in the reptilian stage, big dinosaur companies, you know, killing each other, you know, survival of the company, okay? And then we started the avian age. The avian age was Wilbur and Orville Wright. They took off the ground, flying. And when, now here's the part that's most beautiful, is when did the evolution of the birds complete itself as a social evolution? I think it was it 1969 when we landed on the moon? 69,
yeah,
I think it was.
Sure.
Okay, now why this is critical. Think about this. After the birds in evolution came the mammals, right? When the bird evolution came to its fullest, and that's our society, our bird society, flying, came to the fullest, we landed on the moon. And the moment we landed on the moon, we took a picture of the Earth. And that icon was the icon that changed the population. And what did it change? It said to the population, take care of your planet. And we started taking care of our planet from that point on as a group, right? Now simply ask
Unlike
a question.
Any other time before.
Right. Now ask a question. When you're taking care of something, you're a nurturer. The quality of mammals is nurturing.
Sure.
What happened is from our reptilian dinosaurs came a new population, the meek, the small, and they're coalescing together to do what? To nurture the planet. And in the process, what's happening to the dinosaurs? They're falling over. Big company after big company, downsizing. It doesn't work as dinosaurs. And why is it beautiful for me to see what's happening? Well, everybody's looking around saying, oh my God, the world's falling apart. And I'm looking at, yeah, it is. Great.
Isn't that wonderful?
It's great because the reptile structure doesn't provide for the mammalian vision. And what we have to do is enter into the new age of a mammalian understanding, nurturing, taking care of our planet. Simply go back to the beginning of our discussion. Why? Our planet is our environment. We are the environment. So what we are is the environment. If we don't take care of the environment, we lose ourselves.
Sure.
And so we're in a beautiful era right now. And this era is the end of one phase of evolution and the opening of the mammalian, and that's the highest level.
And, of course, the beginning of the word mammalian is mama.
That's it, Mama Earth, and we're back.
That's right.
Gaia, the Gaia hypothesis, I see, is a very valid understanding with my eyes now compared to before understanding how the cell worked.
That's
it's a very different understanding.
Oh,
it opens up a lot of, you know, if we could take the audience home for about like 2 days, we can really start from the beginning on this because
yeah.
It changes our whole perception of the world, and our perception is what makes us who we are.
I want to come back from the largesse of the evolutionary scheme, which I loved, just to come right back down to Earth and speak of mind-body interactions from a healing point of view, if you don't mind.
Can
you do that? Because since we needed the purview of Moon to see Earth and to get perspective, what we're really talking about now is taking yet another step into ourselves and realize that by healing ourselves, we are simultaneously healing Earth because one is Earth.
That's right. That's a, you know, act locally, think globally or whatever it is. In other words,
and that's real.
I know it's absolutely real. But you can change your own individual life. And then all of a sudden, you start to look around you. It's like the environment is not as bad. Once you change the environment around you as you, then the environment becomes supportive of you. And the issue, here's the issue.
In other words, as you become more and more your own station, if you will,
you get off the dependency of the, you know, the national broadcast, which is telling us who we are. And get back onto the broadcast that we are who we are.
Right.
And we act like you. What do you want out of your life versus what they're telling you you want? Because it's what they're telling you you become.
Exactly. So we've got that first divorce, in a sense, to become conscious of.
Yes.
Of who's telling who what to do and how to be and who to be.
Yes.
And then we've got this other very delicate interface of the antenna on the top of the of all cellular membranes that we can instruct. And since so many people are dying and suffering from things like cancer, which is this alienated, rebellious...
You see, if I would have said traditional point of view, yes, alienated, rebellious cells, because the cells would be thinking on their own. But what we know in the current understanding,
well,
the cells were not that. We were instructing
that.
Okay. I thought, because that's a real critical point. It's not that the cells were rebelling. They were following the instructions.
Oh, I know that. I know that. And so what we need to do is look deeply into the unconscious and see
that's the only way.
Giving the instructions.
Yeah. But see, what would happen is we learn our instructions.
And align that instruction giver.
But you see,
I
we learned our instructions, and here's the beautiful part because this is new chemistry understanding.
Mm-hmm.
We learn our behavior starting in the uterus. Why? Well, it's very simple.
Yeah.
You live off the maternal blood.
Sure.
Emotions are the chemistry of the blood. The emotions are through the chemistry. If the mother is going through an emotional period,
mm-hmm.
the child is not, it can't help but go through the same period. Why? It's using the same blood. It's using the same blood. If the mother has a behavioral thing that repeats itself, the fetus will pick up the chemistry, the chemistry. It doesn't know the meaning. You know, like the mother might be having an argument with its mate or whatever is going on. The child doesn't know the words. It's not interested in the words, but it knows the chemistry. It knows what anger is. It knows what fear
is. It starts to anchor experience.
And yes.
It starts to anchor self-reflection.
Right. See, so we learn these things early. And what is learning? Learning says when a new thing comes in the environment, you make a receptor to see it. Okay? So whatever you're being shown as an environment, you make receptors to see. If you only have a negative environment, then your receptors are only tuned to negative things. So when you open your eyes, can you see something beautiful? Absolutely not. Because all you were trained to see was something negative.
Well, they've done those experiments with cats, I think it was at Harvard, where they raised kittens in a room that only had horizontal stripes. And then other kittens that were raised in a room that only had vertical stripes,
yeah.
And after 6 or 12 weeks of being in that room, they would knock into things that weren't along that
axis.
That axis.
Yeah.
Because they could not perceive it, because it literally was imprinting the eyeball. So literally making the eyeball.
What you're saying is the organism
perception more than anything.
Yes. What you're saying is the organism's perception conforms to its environment.
That's right.
Well, that's what we've been saying all day.
I know.
Okay. And so that's
taking this. That's right. Exactly.
And then you go back to the stuff that I did at Stanford, and I said, look. Here's a cell that's going to be able to either provide for growth or provide for an immune response. Who's going to make the decision? And then it says, it doesn't make the decision based on whether it really needs it or not. It makes it based on what the mind said. So now you go back and say, wait, my mind was making my physiology do this. My body would have said, why would I want to make a pathology? And your mind says, I want you to get into protection. And the body says, I don't think I need it. And the mind says, I don't care if you think you need it or not. I'm telling you you need it. Why? Because my vision, my learning, my experiences, my environment have made this vision real to me, and now I make it real to my cells. And the cells will conform. And they'll go pathology on me with, like, why are we doing this? Because he said so, the boss.
I have a name for one of your books.
What's that?
My Cell, Myself.
Okay, that's bad.
You can borrow it if you want to. But I'd like to come to, this is wonderful, by the way, this immensely, this point that of the interface, so that people, because I know that there are a lot of people who watch this show in particular, who are very interested in what they can do and the way to orchestrate
a change.
Happiness.
Yes. It can be done easily.
A cellular and what we refer to as spiritual level.
Yeah.
And so speak
simply,
a word about that.
Okay. Here's
so
important to understand. Okay.
Minutes.
I'm going to do that.
Okay.
It's important to understand that our behaviors are programmed in us. That we have a conscious level and we have a subconscious level.
Mm-hmm.
The subconscious level is not at our conversational level. My conscious level cannot talk to my subconscious level, but my subconscious level is running the show from behind the scenes.
Right.
So you want to make a change? You have to first not ask yourself, like, what do you want? You have to ask your subconscious what it's thinking. What is it? To ask your subconscious, you want me to be healthy? And so how do you get an answer from your subconscious? And the answer is hypnotherapy. Clinical hypnotherapy.
This is why I've been interested in the subject of physiology of consciousness because of the study of Ericksonian hypnosis.
Yeah. Well, the hypnosis is important because what it does is it gets to the filter of how you really see your life, even though you may see in front of the filter and say, I really want a beautiful life, but somewhere along the line there's a filter that says, you have an ugly life. And if you change the filter, you can have a beautiful life. So where's the filter? You can't ask it. You have to have somebody elicit the subconscious experience. And when you know that, then you can reprogram it. And there's a new kind of programming called the Callahan technique. And you can make behavioral changes 15 minutes. It's like homeopathy of mind. It's like a little bit of information goes a lot farther than trying to do a big, you know, mind trip. They find that you can make changes. Yes, it's just like homeopathy. You can do 15 minutes and have a change that lasts more than a year or two. So the reality is, basically, so you want to make a change. The thing is, if you're not happy where you are, it's really because deep down inside you have a vision that you're looking through that's not a happy vision. The vision was learned from our experiences.
We need to change
things. How did you learn it the first time? By repetition. But how did you learn anything? In school, you had to repeat it. So in our growing up period, we repeated, you're a dumb kid, you're a dumb kid, you're a dumb kid, you're a dumb kid. And after a while, I'm a dumb kid.
So you finally learned.
Yeah, you see? Now the idea is if you want to make a change, you can do it through like a Callahan technique, or you can do it through a traditional method that will give you repetition, like whether a subliminal tape.
I have to get something in before we run out of time, which is, first of all, I have to say thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for giving me a chance to spout.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time. on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.